My guest at this time is South Carolina Republican Congressman Mick Mulvaney. He represents the Palmetto State's 5th Congressional District, and he joins us to talk about a number of subjects, but we'll begin with the fight today up in the House of Representatives over the debt ceiling extension requested by President Obama to the tune of $1.2 trillion. Congressman Mulvaney enters this debate fresh off the one last summer where he opposed both the Boehner Compromise as well as the final compromise that eventually became enacted. And, sir, thank you very much for being with us.
Greg, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, your options certainly in this particular debate are much more limited than last time. You would need a two-thirds majority in both chambers to stop the president from doing this, and clearly that's not going to happen. But what can be done in this debate, if anything, to move the needle in your direction in this debate?
Well, I suppose if you're trying to find a silver lining here, it's that at least it gives us another opportunity to talk about spending, the debts, and deficit. I mean, I had a chance today to go on the floor and ask what is more than a rhetorical question, which is, do we actually intend on paying this money back? I mean, the equivalent, if we were an ordinary family, this would be the equivalent of borrowing roughly $15,000, but the Visa bill is $305,000. If you're in that situation in your family, if you owed $305,000 on the Visa bill, and for some reason Visa decided to give you another $10,000 or $15,000 worth of credit line, would you really intend on ever paying that money back, or would you just take the money because you could get it? And it's an uncomfortable situation or conversation for us to have as a nation, but it's one that I think we should have because I don't think there's the moral intent here to pay this money back. We have no plan to do that. Certainly, I pointed out today that the budget that the president offered last year never balances, never moves to surplus, so it never creates enough money with which to pay down this debt. I think that's a value. Certainly, I'm disappointed. It's whatever moral victories or messaging victories we claim today will be, sort of empty for me because we lost this battle in August. We gave up on this battle in August. We could have stopped the debt ceiling from going up, and we didn't. So it's one of those bittersweet kind of days for me.
Define lost the battle and could have won it. Why do you believe that ultimately your decision to oppose it was the right one, and what would have been a better approach from House or even Senate Republicans to draw a tougher line in the sand last summer?
Well, to skip to your second question first, the alternative was cut cap and balance. It was something the House had passed on a bipartisan basis, would have cut current spending, capped future spending, and provided for a balanced budget to the United States Constitution. It was something, importantly, where we had the popular opinion on our side. The people were with us. They didn't want to raise the debt ceiling. They support a balanced budget amendment. It was the point of really the highest leverage that we were going to have during this entire two-year session of Congress. It was the one chance we had to actually change Washington, and we essentially punted, to use an overused analogy. We decided not to make any tough decisions. We just said, okay, let's let the president make those decisions. We gave the president the effective unilateral right to raise the debt ceiling. Does it give us the ability to go home and look people in the eyes, Republicans, and say, I never voted to raise the debt ceiling? Sure it does. But the truth of the matter is we raised the debt ceiling in August, and that's why I say this is bittersweet. We had the opportunity. We had the vehicle. We had the timing. Everything was working in our favor. And if we'd had the political will, I think we could have accomplished tremendous things last August.
Congressman, so you supported not raising the debt ceiling at all. And, of course, supporters of that position say that $2.2 trillion coming in revenues could have easily paid off the interest on the debt that was what was needed to be done to prevent default, could also pay for some essential government services, and then serious decisions would have had to been made on cutting in entitlements and other areas. Explain where you would have begun some of those big cuts.
Oh, we started the other side of the equation and said, look, everything you're hearing about the default on the debt is not true. We had said all along that the president had both the authority, legal authority, and the money with which to pay down to pay the interest on the debt. And it turns out, I think, in the weeks leading up to the final vote, we'd seen where Tim Geithner was going to Wall Street to assure people that all of the debt would be paid, regardless of what happened. All the interest would be paid. There would have been no default. We also pointed out to people that the rhetoric about Social Security payments not going out was false, and that we turned out to be correct on that one as well. And then we tried to prioritize, and we talked about doing things such as paying the military in the field first and then going down a list. I honestly don't remember. We had five or six different options. We had worked with the Heritage Foundation to come up with five or six different options of a way to keep the government essentially open on a skeleton basis. But it had to stay open very long? No. It could have stayed open a couple of weeks, but we feel like We would have been able during that time to swing the legislative momentum in our favor. If we had, you know, where would we be now? We'd be sitting here with the states debating a balanced budget amendment to the United States Constitution, which would have been a major win for conservatives such as myself.
Critics of your position point out that even after the agreement, which you consider a punt, that the credit rating went down, at least according to Standard & Poor's, and that if there had been no deal, it would have gone down substantially more. Is that a red herring, or is that accurate?
Some of the discussion is, let me tell you what I know about the downgrade. If you had gone to the S&P meetings, which we did, the Budget Committee arranged for us to have various meetings. I think Joint Economic Committee arranged for us to have meetings with the various credit agencies, and they essentially told us, look, if you pass what ultimately passed, you will get downgraded. And it had nothing to do with the process. I heard a lot of that discussion in the press, that the fact that it was dysfunctional and there was this group of conservatives preventing us from doing a clean deal, that's what caused the downgrade. It couldn't be further from the truth. What caused the downgrade was the fact that we evidenced an inability to rein in our spending. We did not address the problem. We got a deal, but we didn't fix anything. And I think that was, if you paid attention to the rating agencies, they did exactly what they said they were going to do if we passed that particular version of the debt ceiling increase. By the way, conversely, each of them unambiguously had said that if we had passed cut, cap, and balance, we would have maintained our AAA credit rating. So certainly, I don't know if red herring is the right way to describe it. There were some valid discussions about the downgrade, but many of us who were paying attention knew that if we had passed the deal that we ultimately passed, the downgrade was coming inevitably.
Do you get the sense from talking to your colleagues that there's a bit of buyer's remorse for going along with the deal last summer? You obviously are seeing what happened since then and are seeing that you made the right decision back then. What are you hearing from your colleagues, and do you get the sense that they're ready to make a tougher stand somewhere along the way, even if they've kind of taken away the opportunity to fight on the debt ceiling?
Well, and that's the unfortunate irony here, is that, yeah, I do think a lot of folks are looking back over August and say, wait a second, that's not what I thought the deal was. I mean, look, part of the deal was the super committee. What was the super committee agreement? It was essentially a deal where we were going to do one of two things. We were either going to dramatically raise taxes, because that was the only way the Democrats would have allowed the super committee to go forward, or we were going to dramatically reduce defense spending, which is what would have happened if the super committee failed. Obviously, we ended up with the second of those two options, but either one of those options is not very attractive to many Republicans. I mean, there's your choice. There's a devil's bargain. Do you want to dramatically raise taxes, or do you want to dramatically reduce defense spending? And I don't think a lot of people understood that that's what they were getting into when they voted on this thing last August. When I say it's an unfortunate irony, the difficulty, of course, now is that folks who looked that hand over and said, wow, now we need to fight, the opportunity's gone. I mean, where are we going to fight? We can't fight on this. We can't stop this debt ceiling increase from going up. There's simply not enough votes because of the way we structured the deal back in August. And there's no other seminal point, there's no other critical linchpin vote that we have to take between now and the next election similar to the opportunity we had on the debt ceiling. So I think the answer is yes, there's a lot of buyer's remorse. But I also think there's a lot of sinking feelings that there's very little we can do to remedy it between now and the next election.
South Carolina Republican Congressman Mick Mulvaney represents his state's 5th Congressional District, also a member of the House Budget Committee. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.